Soon, Hammer and Bull, followed by almost 30 men, rode out of Noyes and headed for Winnipeg.
What are we gonna do when we get there, Hammer?
We gonna look the situation over and see what the lay of the land is. When the time comes to hit the payroll trains, I want to be sure we know every road in and out of Winnipeg, as well as finding some likely spots to hole up if the posses they send after us get too close.
Posses? You think they're gonna have posses ready for us?
No, probably not the first time, Bull. On that one, we probably get a free ride since they won't be expecting anyone to try and rob them. But I don't expect a railroad to take the loss of thousands of dollars laying down. After we take the first payroll, I expect they're gonna have more guards on the second one. So we're gonna have to take different routes to and from the railroad each time we hit it. And I want to make sure we know the country as well as we can before we start taking the railroad's money.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, that's why I'm a ramrod of this outfit, Bull, because of good ideas like that.
They spent the next few days traveling back and forth along the tracks of the railroad into and out of Winnipeg. They made notes on a hand-drawn map Hammer had made, showing the best trails along the way and where they could stop and set up ambushes against any posses or guards that happened to get on their tails. They spent the nights camped out in the open, sleeping under small tents and eating campfire food, with the men complaining bitterly about the bugs and the cold and just about everything else, until finally, Hammer had had enough. Once he had what he wanted, Hammer told the men to divide up and head into Winnipeg.
Go into town in groups of two or three. Don't act like we know each other while we're in town. I don't want the sheriff or marshal or whatever they have up here in the way of the law to know we're all together. Find rooms at different hotels and let me know where you're staying so I won't have any trouble getting in touch with you when the time comes to hit the train.
What are you gonna be doing?
Well, I'm gonna be mixing it up with the railroad men in the saloons around town, trying to find out the schedule of payroll payments, so I'll know when to plan to rob the trains coming into town. I wouldn't want to hit an empty train now, would I?
Hammer and Bull reined in their horses in front of a saloon named the Dog Hole, just in time to see a large, heavyset man run out of the bat wings holding his stomach, his face a pale shade of green. Bull glanced at Hammer as he stepped down off his horse.
Perhaps we better not order any food in here, Hammer.
Hammer hated men who couldn't hold their liquor. He and Bull went into the saloon. Hammer made his way to the bar, and as he leaned on it, he asked the barman what they'd missed that was so damn funny. When the bartender told him the story of the big mountain man and his young friend who'd made the gunny eat almost two dozen eggs, Hammer turned to stare at Smoke Jensen, his lips pursed.
That might be the kind of man I'd like to have in my gang.
As he was preparing to make his way to the table, he saw a large, portly man in a three-piece suit walk into the saloon and join the mountain man.
Who's that sitting with?
The bartender looked at the portly man.
Oh, that's William Cornelius Van Horn. He's in charge of building the railroad from here to the West Coast. Damn fool idea, if you ask me.
Then those men must work for him.
That'd be my guess.
As he sipped his whiskey, Hammer thought of another ploy he might use to get the information he needed.
Stay here, Bull. I'll be back in a few minutes.
Hammer finished his drink and made his way over to the table with Smoke and his friends. When they looked up, Hammer spoke to Van Horn.
I hear you're in charge of building the railroad, Mr. Van Horn.
That's right, mister. Are you looking for work?
Smoke's eyes examined Hammer, noting the way his gun was tied down low on his thigh, and also noting his hands had no calluses on them.
I don't think he's interested in working on the railroad, Bill. He doesn't look like a laborer to me.
You're right about that, mister. I'm more interested in security work, if there is any.
Security work?
Well, you know, like keeping men in line if they get too rowdy, or perhaps guard work if you have anything to guard.
Van Horn pursed his lips, taking in the confident manner Hammer had about him. He slowly nodded.
There might be some way I could use you. Let me talk to my foreman about it and ask me again in a day or two.
Hammer nodded and touched the brim of his hat.
Thank you kindly, Mr. Van Horn.
Yeah, that galoot smells like trouble to me, Bill. I ain't one to tell nobody their business, but I'd steer clear of that sort if I was you.
Beartooth, if I failed to hire men simply because they looked a little rough around the edges, I wouldn't have more than a dozen men working for me instead of almost 20,000.
In that case, I agree with Beartooth, Bill. That man's eyes were dead. I have a feeling you'd be sorry if you hired him.
Van Horn stared at Smoke for a moment, his face thoughtful.
One thing I've learned over the years, Bill, Smoke Jensen is the best judge of character I've ever met. If he tells you a man is bad, you can take that to the bank.
You know I respect your opinion, Smoke. So if he does come back, I'll turn him down. Now, come on over to the railroad yard. There are some people I'd like you all to meet before we start work on the survey.
Mr. Van Horn.
Yes, Pearly.
We ain't had no lunch yet, except in Cal and his boiled eggs, and it's way past noon, and I was wondering if you had any grub over at the railroad yard.
Sure, Pearly. As soon as we get there, I'll have Cookie make you all up something to take the edge off your appetite until we get dinner tonight.
The only thing to take the edge off Pearly's appetite, Bill, is to feed him an entire cow.
When the group arrived at the railroad yard about a mile and a half out of town, they were all amazed to see over 1,000 tents set up and thousands of men milling around a large compound that contained several odd-looking machines. Van Horn told them they were used to travel down the tracks as they were laid and bring supplies to the men working the lines.
Jimmy, how many men you got working for you, Bill?
Over 20,000 so far.
How come most of them seem to be staying out here in tents instead of in town?
Well, most of the men are of Chinese descent. And as you saw by the sign in the saloon, town folk don't exactly welcome Chinese. As for the others, most are men like you, Rattlesnake. They're used to living out in the open and feel cooped up when they're in a hotel room.
You say you've got over 20,000 men, Bill?
That's right.
And I suppose most of them are being paid about $1 a day or so?
Well, the Chinese don't make that much, but I suppose that's about the average.
So when payday comes around, you're paying out almost $500,000 a month, I guess.
Probably about that much. But I don't really know for certain, Lewis. My job is to get the track laid. Paying them for doing it is someone else's headache.
What are you getting at, Lewis?
I don't know, really. It's just seeing that hard-eyed fellow at the saloon asking about security made me think that $500,000 would make an awfully tempting pie for someone to try and cut himself a piece of.
Oh, well, you don't have to worry about that, Lewis. The payroll train is heavily guarded, and the money is kept in a large safe in a boxcar that is bolted to the floor and is much too heavy to carry off.
What if some robbers held a gun to the guards? Couldn't they make him open it up?
Not a chance. No one on the train has the combination to the safe, so even if they wanted to, they couldn't get into it.
That makes me feel a lot better, because now I know I'm going to get paid for all this work we're going to be doing. Now, if we could just get fed, I'd feel a lot better.
Well, then, come on, men. I'll introduce you to Cookie and see if he can find you all something to eat.
That's good. There's one man on the crew I'd like to know personally. It's the cook.
That's a fact. And I can tell you one thing for sure. He's going to get awfully tired of your face hanging around asking him when the next meal's going to be ready.
Later that evening, Hammer sent Bull off to have supper with some of the men at a local restaurant while he went back to the dog hole to see if perhaps the man named Van Horn was there. He wanted to see if the man had considered his request for security work. He stood inside the bat wings for a moment, looking around the place, but he didn't see either Van Horn or any of the other men who'd been with him at noon. The man had the cold, calculating eyes of a star packer of some sort. So Hammer decided to approach him and see what he could learn. He walked over to the table.
Howdy.
The man looked up from his drink and turned his black eyes on Hammer. No expression of welcome in him.
Do I know you? No, I don't think so. But you have the look of a lawman about you. And since I used to carry a badge myself, I thought if I was right, I'd offer to buy you a drink.
The man's expression softened a little, though his eyes remained suspicious. Lawmen weren't always welcome in frontier towns, and it was wise to be cautious when talking to strangers, especially in saloons. The man leaned back and let his hand drop to his waist, and Hammer could see the butt of a pistol in a shoulder holster under his coat.
You're partially right. I carry a badge, but it's private. I work for the Pinkerton Agency.
Close enough. My name's John Brody. I used to work for the hanging judge over at Fort Smith, Arkansas, a while back.
Oh, Judge Isaac Parker. I met him once. He's as hard as a granite boulder.
Yeah, you got that right.
My name's Albert Knowles.
By the way, I thought the Pinkertons only worked in the States.
That's changing. Now that Canada is getting strongly into the railroad building business, James Hill, who we've done a lot of work for in the States, has decided to use us for a security force. That's how the Pinkertons got started in the first place, working as railroad detectives.
More business is always good, I expect.
Damn right.
Now, I saw all those men camped out by the rail yard. There must be thousands of them.
Almost 20,000, though. Most of them are Chinese.
Damn. Well, that must mean a huge payroll.
You have no idea, John.
Well, that's a big responsibility, guarding that much money. Now, I handled some pretty big jobs as a marshal, but I don't know as I'd want to take that on.
No, it's not so hard. I got 10 men hiding in the boxcar with a safe, all armed with the latest Henry repeating rifles and Winchesters. And I got another 10 riding in the car behind, with horses all saddled and ready just in case they need to take out after some would-be robbers. A few men tried to rob us on the first run last month, but we took care of them.
Well, what'd you do, Al?
The ones we didn't kill outright, we strung up to the nearest telegraph pole and watched them dance till they was deader than yesterday's news. Then we brought them into town and set them up in caskets in front of the local undertaker's office with a sign on them that said, "This is what happens to train robbers."
Whew. I guess a man would have to be crazy to try to hit one of your payroll trains after seeing that.
Yeah, that's why we haven't had no more trouble since that first time. And if it was up to me, those bodies would still be there, though I'd suspect they'd be a mite right by now. But Mr. Van Horn ordered them taken down and buried over in Boot Hill. Shame, too, with some of my best work.
Huh. So this Mr. Van Horn don't appreciate you, huh?
No, it ain't that. It's just that Mr. Van Horn is a real decent man, though he's hard as nails if you don't do your job. Well, it's about that time, John. Be seeing you.
Oh, you're right about that, Al. You'll be seeing me again, and a lot sooner than you think.
While Hammer was pumping the Pinkerton man for information, Van Horn was treating Smoke and his friends to dinner at the restaurant attached to the Rooster's Roost Hotel. Van Horn noticed Beartooth and Red Bingham glancing nervously around the room and whispering to one another.
Beartooth, Red, is anything wrong?
Bill, it's just that we're not used to eating indoors.
Yeah, it don't seem natural somehow.
But you ate in the car on the train.
Well, but that was different. Then it was just us eating, kind of like being in camp with your partners. Here, there's a whole passel of strangers around watching us eat.
Lewis, who was holding a glass of real brandy in his hands, not that homemade variety he'd had at the dog hole, looked up as he swirled the amber liquid around in the snifter.
Oh, you'll get used to it, boys. The only difference from eating outdoors is there are far fewer bugs to bother you while you eat.
Yes, but don't get too used to it, men. We're going to be taking off in a day or two for the wilds of Canada to do some surveying.
Lewis looked up as a tall, slim man wearing buckskins entered the door to the restaurant and looked around. Van Horn held up his hand and waved him over. As he approached their table, Smoke noticed he had the sun-wrinkled face and observant eyes of a mountain man. But unlike most of those he'd known in the past, the man's beard was short and well-trimmed.
Gentlemen, this is Tom Wilson. He's the leader of our surveying crew.
So, you're to be our new boss, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm Smoke Jensen.
Smoke introduced the others at the table, who all nodded and then went back to their food and drink. Wilson's eyes took in the other mountain men at the table and then moved over Smoke's broad shoulders and muscled arms.
You boys all look like you got some hair on you.
Wilson hesitated, glancing at Lewis in his fancy clothes and at Cal and Pearly.
At least most of you do.
Oh, by the way, Tom, don't let Lewis's clothes or the boys' young years fool you. They've all been tested by fire, and I'll guarantee you they're up to the job.
I've been trying to remember where I heard that name, Smoke Jensen, before.
Huh?
Yeah, it was last year, right after the spring thaw, and I was up in the mountains just north of here checking out the elk herds, fixing to do some hunting, when I ran across one of the oldest men I ever met, who wasn't sitting in a rocking chair on a porch somewhere.
He give you a name?
Yeah, old Beaver said he was called Preacher.
The name Preacher got the immediate attention of all the mountain men at the table, Preacher being a legend among them. Wilson reached behind him, took a chair from a nearby table and pulled it around, sitting on it backward with his arms folded over the back of the chair.
Well, one thing led to another, and we made a camp together up there in the High Lonesome. This Preacher, he made me some coffee that'd take the hair off a bear hide, and then he proceeded to tell me he'd come all the way up here to Canada from down Colorado way, because it was getting too crowded in the mountains down there. He said he couldn't hardly trap any beaver for tripping over pilgrims and such all the time.
Jesus. Old Preacher must be in his 80s at least by now.
I just assumed the old codger had holed up somewheres and died.
You're right, man. Preacher had to be at least 80. And it looked like he'd been rode hard and put up wet besides. Anyway, some of the tales he told me I put down a typical mountain man exaggeration. Especially the one about the young pilgrim he met years ago, who was fast as grease lightning with a handgun, and to hear a preacher tell it, as hard as an anvil.
Well, sonny boy, even he was talking about smoke here. You can take what he said to heart, no matter how outrageous it sounded.
I wish I'd been here to see him. We had some fun times in the old days. Hairy as hell, but fun nevertheless.
If half of what he said about you is true, Smoke, it's going to be a pleasure to ride the peaks with you.
And if it's not?
Then you probably won't make it across the mountains, and neither will the rest of you. Boys, the mountains in Colorado ain't nothing compared to what you're going to see up here. Besides stony Indians, who just as soon as scalp you and eat your heart as look at you, we got just about every kind of wild creature ever born with fangs and claws up here. There ain't been more than a handful of whites that even tried to cross the territory we're going at, and half of them never lived to tell about what they seen.
If the surveying job is so difficult and dangerous, why did you agree to ramrod the team?
Hell, I was going to be up in the mountains anyway, since that's what I do. So why not take the railroad's money for doing what comes natural? The question is, since y'all seem to have at least most of your senses, why'd you have to agree to take such a job on?
Probably for the same reason Preacher told you he was up here. Colorado's getting crowded. Most of the Indians have been either wiped out or beaten into submission. And like you say, we'd be up in the mountains anyway. So why not see some new country and get paid for it?
Good enough, then. I'll see you men about sunup in the morning. And we'll get started going toward the mountain to see if we can find a pass for Mr. Van Horn to drive his iron horse through.
And by the way, Tom, whatever happened to Preacher after your camp together?
Hell if I know. I woke up the next morning, the coffee was made, and there was no sign of the old man. He'd vanished in the woods, as if he'd never even been there. I tried to track him, and believe me when I say I can track a fart in a windstorm, and I couldn't even tell which way he'd gone.
That's Preacher, all right. He once told me he could walk across mud without leaving a print, and damned if I don't believe it.
The next morning, they were all sitting around the table in the huge mess tent in the rail yard, stuffing down flapjacks and eggs and bacon and beans as fast as they could. Pearly had even taken a few sinkers and slathered thick white gravy over them and was eating them as well. Van Horn appeared, unshaven, his clothes rumpled and untidy.
What happened to you, Bill?
This is a mite too early for me, Smoke. I usually wait until at least dawn to crawl out of bed, but then I also usually work until after midnight when I'm in the middle of laying track.
Where's Tom Wilson? I figured he'd have his tent here near the camp.
Not Tom. He's not exactly what I'd call the most sociable fellow I've ever met. He usually makes his own camp a ways away from the rest of the crew. Says it's just about all he can do to stand other people's company all day without having to listen to them snore all night.
You mean he just up and heads off when the day's work's done?
That's about the size of it. Old Tom's a real loner.
It ain't that I'm a loner.
Wilson spoke from the tent door as he entered and picked up a plate.
It's just that I ain't found all that many people I enjoy being around much is all.
Cal watched wide-eyed as Tom piled on even more food than Pearly had.
Jiminy, Mr. Wilson, I ain't never seen nobody eat more than Pearly here.
One thing you learn out here in High Lonesome, youngins, is to eat as much as you can whenever you got the chance, because you never know when you'll get your next chance to eat.
Heck, fire, my friend Pearly's been following that advice for as long as I've known him. And he don't even live up in the mountains.
While they finished their breakfast, Van Horn pulled out a wrinkled hand-drawn map from his coat pocket. He handed the map to Smoke.
I've drawn a rough sketch of what we know about the mountain ranges to the north and west of Winnipeg, and I've penciled in a rough line where I want the tracks to go, with provisions, of course, for any detours we might have to make around peaks or valleys in the mountain range.
Tom Wilson glanced up from his food long enough to pull several sheets of paper from his breast pocket and pass them over to Smoke.
Here's some more maps for Smoke. They detail several routes explored by others some years back.
Smoke looked at the maps. They were labeled with the names Dawson, Palliser, and Fleming.
Which one of these do you think is the best bet to try, Tom?
Won't know till we get out there. But from what I read in the journals of the men involved, I think Fleming's more northern routes offer the best chance of finding some passes through the Selkirks and Caribou Mountains.
Then I guess we'll try the northern routes first, assuming we can get through the snowpacks.
And assuming we can find suitable portages across the rivers that dot the area.
Rivers? You mean we're gonna have to cross freezing rivers on this?
Unless you can fly, boy. That's about the size of it.
Just how many men are you planning on taking with us on this little jaunt?
Just three, in addition to us here at the table. William and Thomas McCardle and Frank McCabe would be good men to have with us, I think. They're experienced surveyors, and if we run into the Stony Indians, we're gonna need every gun we can carry to get us through.
You think there's much chance of that?
Do you think there's much chance of it snowing up here in the winter? It's not a question of whether we run into the Indians, Pearly, but of when it's gonna happen.
The trick to fighting Indians, young'un, is to see them before they see you. Cause if it's the other way around, well, there won't be much fighting going on, just a whole hell of a lot of dying.
While Smoke and his men were eating breakfast, Hammer Hammerick and his gang were stationed alongside the railroad tracks leading into Winnipeg, about 10 miles out of the town. He'd worked out a plan to deal with the Pinkerton men stationed on the train as guards, and he was anxious to see if it would work. He had his 30 men lined up in wooded areas on either side of the track. As the rails made a long, sweeping curve to the right, he'd had his men loosen the tracks just enough to derail the train, but leave them in place so the engineer wouldn't see anything amiss. Each of his men had been supplied with several sticks of dynamite and fuses attached. As the engine made the curve, its wheels jumped track and the cars following began a crazy dance, waving back and forth and tipping first to one side and then to the other as they ran off the tracks and onto the soft dirt alongside. The train was soon completely derailed. When the rest of the cars had come to a stop, Hammer and his men rode their horses out of the woods and galloped toward the disabled train, lighting fuses from cigars in their mouths and pitching them toward the cars containing the Pinkerton men. Hammer reined his horse in next to the boxcar containing the large iron safe and the dead and wounded bodies of the Pinkerton agents, lying scattered all around the ruined car amid body parts, blood, and dead horse. As he dismounted, he looked around at the men on the ground. There were over 20 men, some still alive, partially buried in the splintered pieces of wood from the car. He, like all of his men, covered his face with a bandana, so he didn't feel the need to execute the wounded men. But he was careful to make sure none were in any shape to take a shot at him with the rifles they had nearby.
Bull, make sure you and the men pick up the weapons, especially from the wounded men. We wouldn't want them taking pot shots at us while we get the safe open.
Hammer climbed up on the stack of broken lumber, pulling boards aside until he was standing next to the big iron safe lying on its side in the wreckage. After examining the safe's door for a moment, he saw that it had a combination lock on it, just as Albert Knowles had said it did. He reached into the gunny sack he was carrying, took out a stack of dynamite sticks he'd tied together with a piece of twine. He wedged the dynamite under the door just next to the dial on the lock. Then he took a cigar out of his mouth.
You ready, Bull?
Yeah, boss. Just let me get a little bit further away before you light that bundle. Jesus, boss. Maybe you shouldn't have used so much dynamite.
Hammer grimaced. Bull was right, but he knew he'd had to be sure the amount was enough to open the safe. He stepped out around the edge of the car they'd been hiding behind and walked through the dust cloud toward what remained of the boxcar. Hammer was surprised to see a large crater over 3 feet deep where the safe had been. The safe was lying open, its door bent and twisted with one hinge completely off. Piles of paper were burning, small bits of the bills rising on heat waves into the air and glowing like fireflies on a summer night.
Damn it!
He just assumed it would be in gold or silver coin.
Where's the gold, boss?
There isn't any, Bull! Those assholes are paying the men with Canadian paper money, not gold.
Aw, shit. You mean we did all this for nothing?
Hammer stood up, smiling and holding up the bundles of bills he'd been able to salvage from the fire.
Not exactly for nothing. Looks like we got about $50,000 here, boys, give or take a few thousand. Not exactly bad pay for one day's work. Now send the men out to search the bodies. Take anything of value, including watches and any guns they're carrying.
But boss, some of them bodies have been torn apart. We'll get all messed up with blood and guts and stuff.
Oh, just do it, Bull. You've had blood on your hands before, and after all, you're being paid pretty damn good for it. Pretty soon they're gonna realize this train's behind schedule, and they're gonna be sending a posse out here to see where it is. I'd kinda like to be gone by then.
Sure thing, boss. I'll get the men right on it.
Tom Wilson had the men lined up and ready to depart, along with several pack horses loaded with supplies, extra ammunition, and tents, when Bill Van Horn came running toward him, waving his arms.
We've got trouble, Tom. Bad trouble with the payroll train.
What else is new, Bill? There's always something going on out here. What happened? Didn't they send enough money from headquarters?
It's not that, Tom. The payroll train has been hit. Apparently, the bastards used dynamite. I made a mess of the whole thing. Almost every one of my security men was on that train.
Why are you telling us this, Bill? We're a surveying party, not part of your security forces.
I was wondering if you'd be willing to head out there and see what you could do, Smoke. You have a certain reputation for handling men like this. And since my Pinkertons are probably out of commission, I'm in desperate need of someone who knows his way around a gun to take charge of this mess.
How about if I take Lewis and Cal and Pearly with me? Leaving the mountain men to help Tom with the survey until we can get back and catch up to them.
That all right with you, Tom?
Sure. We ain't going to get into any hairy areas for at least a week. First part of Fleming's trail is pretty straightforward until we get up into the mountains, and I'm going to be leaving a blazed trail for the railroad workers to follow anyhow. I don't see where it'd be a problem, long as they catch up to us before we get into Stony Indian territory.
That all right with you?
Hell yes. I'm ready for a little excitement. So this'll be a pleasure.
We're with you, Smoke. And where you go, we go.
Smoke looked back down at Van Horn.
Get me another pack horse and load it up with plenty of ammunition. Some extra firearms, sharps if you have one, and enough food and supplies for 2 weeks. By then, we'll either have them, or they'll be long gone.
All right, you and your men head on out to the wreckage site, and I'll be right behind you with some wagons and our medical people to see how many of the Pinkertons we can save.
Robert, the gun's loose and loaded. Six up and six, Smoke. Anyone who'd kill that many men just to steal some payroll ain't to be trifled with.
I've met plenty of that kind before, Tom. I know how to handle them.
Don't give them no quarter, Smoke Boy. Just shoot them down like the animals they is.
10 minutes later, Van Horn had two pack horses loaded with what Smoke had asked for. Smoke, Cal, Pearly, and Lewis put their spurs to their mounts, pack animals following on daily ropes wrapped around Cal and Pearly's saddle horns. Van Horn told them to just follow the tracks out of town and they'd come to the ambush site within a few miles. They rode on the cleared area right next to the train tracks. They did so they wouldn't have to slow down to weave through the forests and woods that were thick in the area. It took them less than an hour, pushing the horses as fast as they could, before they could see dark smoke rising on afternoon air currents to cover the sky like storm clouds ahead of them. Smoke slowed his mount and loosened the hammer thongs on his pistols as he pulled his Winchester 73 from his saddle boot.
Jimmy, what's that god-awful smell?
That's the smell of burning flesh, Cal. Once you smell it, smell you'll never forget.
Smoke and the others walked their horses around a turn in the tracks, just in time to see a group of men mounting up on the horses and beginning to ride off in a direction away from them. Pearly jumped off his horse, pulled the Sharp's big 50 from its scabbard on the pack horse, and laid it across the rear of the animal, taking aim at one of the fleeing outlaws.
Hold on, Pearly.
I can get one or two before they get out of range.
Yeah, but then they'll know we're on their trail. Let them go for now. We'll follow them until they make camp. And then we'll be able to set up an ambush and take out more than one or two before they know what hit them.
I never thought of that.
Smoke's right, Pearly. It appears they have us outnumbered 5 or 6 to 1. So we're going to have to outthink them as well as outfight them if we're to have any chance of bringing them to justice.
Let's head on down there and see if there's anyone left alive that we can help out until Bill gets here with the doctor.
Lewis moved his binoculars as he surveyed the scene down by the rail tracks.
I think I can see a few men moving, but they all look like they're in a bad way. It'll be a miracle if more than a handful are still alive.
I wonder why they didn't kill all of the wounded men when they had the chance.
They probably wore masks and didn't think it was necessary. But hopefully, some of the wounded may have heard or seen something that will help us as we track the bastards down.
Cal shook his head as he followed Smoke down the rise toward the wrecked train.
Gotta tell you, Smoke, I ain't looking forward to this job.
Hammer and his men, their horses loaded down with rifles, handguns, and the personal property of the men they'd robbed on the train, made their way up slopes still partially covered with snow toward the higher elevations of the hills around the ambush site. Bull Banyan twisted in his saddle and looked at the rail behind him.
We're leaving a pretty easy trail for the posse to follow, Hammer.
Don't worry about it, Bull. Looks to me like we got us a spring storm coming for too long. By the time it clears enough for a party to catch up with us, we'll be across the border back in Noyes.
Yeah, and with the temperature being so cold for this time of year, it'll probably be snow rather than rain.
Well, that should take care of any tracks we leave. And judging by the number of Pinkertons on that train, I don't expect the railroad men are going to have too many security people left to take off after us anyhow.
So you're planning on heading straight back to Noyes?
That's right. We need to lay low for a couple of days. But I plan on coming back here within the week.
How come?
Think about it, son. We just destroyed the entire payroll for the railroad workers back there. They ain't gonna take kindly to being told there won't be no pay this week.
So?
Well, Bull, they're gonna have to send another train right away, just as soon as they can get those tracks fixed. I thought when they do, we might just set up another ambush. Maybe it might further back up the line and see if this time we can get money out of the safe without burning it up.
But boss, won't they be expecting us to do that very thing?
No. Now, I expect they think we took off for parts unknown, especially if they follow the direction of our tracks and see we headed back across the border. Yeah, but even if they do, where are they going to get another carload of guards so fast? Pinkerton men don't exactly grow on trees around here.
Maybe they'll just use railroad workers as guards.
Yeah, you're probably right, Bull. The railroad workers ain't exactly experienced gunmen now, are they? Once we blow up that car and commence to shooting, my guess is they'll hightail it for the nearest cover, leaving the safe to us.
So I guess that means we're going to be camping out tonight in this storm that's fixing to hit.
That's right. Since there's no way we can make it all the way back to Noyes today. Once we get far enough away from the tracks and back in these thick woods, we'll fix us a big fire and pitch our tents real close to it. This time of year, the storm shouldn't last overly long.
I hope you're right, boss, because I don't really sit through a real winter norther out in the open.
Just keep thinking of $50,000, Bull. That ought to warm you up better than a campfire.
As soon as the outlaws were out of sight, Smoke and his men came down off the hillock overlooking the railroad tracks and approached the wrecked site.
Jesus.
They got down off their horses, began to move among the dead and wounded. The final tally was 18 dead, 6 injured so badly it was doubtful they would survive, and 5 with non-life-threatening wounds. When they had done all they could to stop the bleeding and get the wounded covered, Smoke asked Cal to start a fire near where the men lay, to give him some warmth and to get some coffee brewed. The more seriously wounded, he gave small drinks of water and whiskey mixed together to help ease their pain. While Cal and Pearly gave the others coffee when it was ready, Smoke and Lewis stood nearby, smoking cigars as they drank some coffee in tin mugs, cradling the mugs in their hands to keep them warm.
I've seen a lot of bad men in my time out west, Smoke. But I don't know as I've ever seen anyone who could do this and just ride away as if nothing had happened.
I know what you mean, Lewis. I want you all to remember the sight when we finally catch up with the men that did this. Because I do not intend to give them any quarter or mercy. And if any of you have any reservations about what I'm going to do, you better head on back to the rail yard with Van Horn and the wounded men when he gets here.
Don't worry about me, Smoke. Whatever you've got planned for the bastards that did this is too good for them.
Just remember you said that, Val. When the blood starts to flow and the outlaws' bodies start to pile up.
Within an hour, Van Horn showed up with 10 covered wagons and a doctor and nurse, along with 10 hard-looking men, to take care of the dead and wounded. As the doctor and nurse began to examine and care for the wounded, Van Horn and the other men moved among the dead bodies of the Pinkerton agents who'd been killed by the outlaws. Van Horn, a man not unused to violence, stood looking around with tears in his eyes.
I cannot imagine the depth of evil of the men who did this.
He turned to Smoke and Lewis, who stood next to him with Cal and Pearly behind him.
The railroad will offer a $10,000 bonus to you and your men if you capture or kill the bastards responsible for this outrage, Smoke.
Smoke glanced at the others, who all shook their heads.
No, Bill. That's not necessary. My men and I will track the sons of bitches down for you and do whatever is necessary to bring them to justice without any thought of reward or payment.
Yes, Bill. There are some things money can't buy, and justice for the dead is one of them.
Thank you, men.
From over where the wounded lay, the doctor raised his head.
Mr. Van Horn, one of the men wants to talk to you.
The group walked over and stood next to the man the doctor was kneeling next to. It was Albert Knowles, the chief detective assigned to head the Pinkerton contingent on the train. His left leg was lying at a funny angle, and there were cuts and smoke burns on his face and hands.
Albert, how are you doing?
I'm all right, Mr. Van Horn. At least I'm in better shape than most of my men.
Don't blame yourself for this, Al. There was nothing you could have done against an attack like this.
No, Mr. Van Horn, I'm afraid I am to blame for this.
How's that, Al? How can you possibly blame yourself for this atrocity?
I think I recognize the voice of the leader of the men who blew up the train.
Oh?
Yes, sir. While I was eating lunch at a saloon in town, a man approached me and told me he was an ex-marshal from down Fort Smith way. We got to talking, and he asked a lot of questions about the security arrangements on the payroll trains. I didn't think much about it, and he did in such a way as not to arouse my suspicions. But I can see now he was pumping me for information on where my men would be stationed on the train to use against us.
What was his name?
He said his name was John Brody, but I doubt he was telling the truth.
Knowles went on to describe the man he'd talked to in detail, as only an experienced detective can.
Bill, doesn't that sound a lot like the man who came up to us the other day while we were in town eating, who inquired about a security job?
Damn, Smoke, I think you're right.
He didn't give a name, as I recollect, but I think Smoke had him pegged from the get-go.
That's right. He sure as hell didn't look like he'd spent much time using his hands for manual labor. And he wore his sidearm like a man who knew how to use it, tied down low on his hip.
Well, whatever the hell his name is and wherever he goes to try and hide, I want him brought down, one way or another.
Hammer and his men rode hard for the rest of the day to put as much distance between them and the railroad as they could, until just before dusk they came to a large lake. The edges of the lake were still rimmed with ice, with large patches out away from the shore showing brilliant blue water where the ice was beginning to melt. About 20 yards from shore, the dead body of a large elk floated in an open hole in the ice where he'd evidently fallen through the ice pack.
Looky there, Hammer. That sumbitch must weigh over 1,000 pounds.
Yeah. And that elk meat would taste mighty good if we cooked it over a fire.
Hammer glanced around. The place where they'd stopped had a good cover of trees growing by the edge of the lake and was moderately well protected from the frigid north wind blowing across the lake toward them.
Why don't you see if you and the boys can get a rope around his horns and drag him to shore? We'll make camp here and see about cooking up some hot food.
By the time Bull and a couple of other gang members had managed to rope and drag the elk to shore, using long ropes tied to their saddle horns, Hammer had a roaring fire going in the center of the copse of trees they were camping in. Coffee had been brewed in several pots, and the men were mixing it with generous dollops of whiskey and brandy to ward off the chill as the temperature continued to fall. Large, wet flakes of snow began to drift downward from the dark clouds overhead. The wind, instead of dying at dusk as it usually did, was freshening as the storm built to its full force and the snowfall intensified. Soon the charred meat was being cut up and passed out among the men, who were eating it with large plates of pinto beans and hard biscuits that had to be dunked in their coffee before they could be chewed. As the men ate, they also drank a great deal of whiskey, trying to keep warm. Before long, they were all in a festive, half-drunk mood, and they were all talking about how they planned to spend that money they'd stolen from the train. Smokin' Lewis and Cal and Pearly lay on their stomachs, peering through binoculars over a ridge at the outlaws' camp 200 yards away. They'd laid their ground blankets down so the dampness of the ground wouldn't get their clothes wet, a sure way to freeze to death in this weather. The snow was falling heavier now, and the brims of their hats and their shoulders were becoming covered with ice. Though the others were shivering from the cold, Smoke didn't even notice it, the fires of vengeance burning in his gut and keeping him warm.
I make it about 35 men, give or take a couple.
Me too.
Wonder why they made that fire so big. Like they ain't afraid of nobody seeing it.
Now they probably think that since they killed most of the Pinkertons, there ain't nobody on their trail yet.
You're right, Cal. That and a storm that's come up to cover their tracks gives them a false sense of safety.
You planning on hitting them tonight?
Yes, but not just yet. Let's pull back a mile or so and build us a fire. We'll eat, feed our horses, and get warm, and wait until just before dawn to attack. That way the sentries, if they bother to post them, will be tired enough that they won't be effective.
They followed him as he eased back off the ridge and got up on his mount. He walked away from the outlaws for a half an hour and then found a good spot for a camp, nestled in a thick grove of tall pines and maple trees in a small depression, surrounded by heavy boulders that would hide the light from their campfire.
Gather up as many pine cones as you can carry. They'll light easy and burn hot and get the wet wood going for a fire.
While the boys were gathering pine cones and sticks of wood, Smoke set about making coffee and fixing a camp supper that would give them the energy they were going to need later on that night. Lewis saw to the horses, getting them covered with blankets and setting out piles of grain for them to eat. Once the fire was going, he would melt some snow for them to drink. After they'd eaten and filled their bellies with plenty of hot coffee, Smoke showed them how to gather tree limbs covered with pine needles and lay them in piles up against the trunks of some of the larger pine trees. They put the ground blankets down, crawled into their sleeping blankets near the fire, and pulled the tree limbs over them. The pine needles on the limbs kept both the snow and the cold away from them, and they slept snug as bugs in rugs. At almost exactly 3 a.m, Smoke came awake. Years of living in the high lonesome had helped him develop an internal alarm clock that rarely failed to waken him whenever he wanted. He crawled out from under his blankets and pine limbs to find almost 2 feet of snow had fallen. He threw some pine cones on the red-hot embers of the fire and prepared another large pot of coffee before waking the others. By the time Lewis and Cal and Pearly were up and awake, he was sitting next to a roaring fire, sipping steaming hot coffee from his mug and planning his next move. As Lewis filled their mugs, he glanced over at Smoke.
All right, Smoke, what's our next move?
There's too many of them to just go into the camp with our guns blazing. We could probably get most of them, but sure as hell they'd manage to get a couple of us before we finish them off.
So what should we do? Maybe we could surround them and shoot down into their camp from a distance.
No, son, it's too dark for accurate fire. And even then, there's so many of them that they'd be able to mount an attack on us before we could get them all.
You're right, Lewis. So here's what we're gonna do, man.
Cal and Pearly and Lewis squatted down on their haunches next to the fire. They listened as Smoke outlined his plan of attack. Squatty Lyons was leaning back against the bole of a ponderosa pine, his arms crossed over his chest and his chin tucked into the collar of his rawhide coat against the north wind. He glanced over at the long line of horses tied one after another to a rope strung between two trees as he fumbled in his coat and tried to keep his hands from shaking while he built himself a cigarette. Suddenly, he sat up straighter and he reached for the new Winchester he had between its legs because he saw a shadow moving over near the horse string.
Adios, pond scum.
Lewis moved silently off, looking for another sentry. He fought the nausea the killing had caused in his stomach. He was used to standing face to face with men he was up against. And the thought of sneaking up on a man and killing him from behind went against his grain. Of course, these dirty bastards deserve no mercy, he told himself. And he steeled his conscience for the next man he was gonna kill. Cal and Pearly, watching from behind some nearby bushes, moved to the rope holding the horses when they saw the guard fall. A quick flick of Cal's knife at one end and of Pearly's at the other, and the rope parted. Being careful not to spook the animals into whinnying, Pearly and Cal took the ends of the ropes and slowly led the horses away from the camp and deeper into the forest. On the other side of the camp, Roy Woodson was walking in small circles and flapping his arms against his chest, trying to keep warm as he kept watch over the packs and supplies that had been stacked there earlier. He left his rifle sitting on the ground, leaning up against one of the packs, so he could put his hands in his pockets of his coat to keep them warm. He turned rapidly, his heart beating fast. He peered into the gloom at the ghostly whiteness of the ice and snow, wishing like hell the moon were out so he could see what had made the sound.
Hey, did you forget this?
Roy opened his mouth to shout for help and Smoke swung the rifle as hard as he could. Smoke crouched and waited to see if anyone had heard the sound of the sentry hitting the ground. When there was no response, he straightened up and moved over to the stack of supplies. He took two sticks of dynamite out of his coat pocket and placed them under the stack of packs and boxes and supplies the man had been guarding. Smoke lit a two-minute fuse. He moved toward the campfire in the middle of camp. As he walked quickly by the embers of the campfire, he reached out and dumped the contents of a cardboard box into the coals, along with a burlap sack full of pine cones. He kept moving. He moved out to join Lewis and the boys. Cal handed him his Henry repeating rifle. The four men settled down behind the trunk of a large pine tree that had been felled by lightning, and they aimed their rifles across its bark.
Remember, fire only until your rifles are empty. Then hightail it out of here towards the horses.
Dark figures could be seen outlined in the firelight as they scrambled for their boots and weapons, shouting at each other and trying to figure out what the hell had happened. Suddenly, a box full of 10-gauge double-aught buckshot shells Smoke had put into the fire began to explode.
Now!
As Cal fired his last bullet, Pearly grabbed him by the collar and jerked him to his feet.
Come on, cowboy. Unless you want to be left behind.
The four men jogged to their horses tied a dozen yards away and they swung up into their saddles just as answering fire from the camp began to whine over their heads.
Shag your mouth, boys. It's about to get real exciting around here before too long.
As they rode off into the night, they took the time to scatter the outlaws' horses ahead of them. Few, if any, of the animals would be able to be tracked down by the men they'd attacked. Once they were out of rifle range, Smoke slowed his horse and stopped long enough to take out a handful of cigars and pass them around to the others.
A good night's work, men.
There's at least a few of those treacherous bastards who won't be killing any more men again.
Amen to that, Lewis.
I'll teach you, sorry sons of bitches!
When he heard the sound of their attackers' horses riding off into the darkness, Hammer came out from behind the tree he'd hidden behind and surveyed the damage to their camp. Blood was running down his face from a wound on his forehead where a slug from a shotgun shell had creased his skin, and he had a hole in his trouser leg where a piece of wood from the dynamite explosion had torn right through it, barely missing his thigh. Four men lay dead near the campfire where the exploding shotgun shells had torn them apart. Two more had died in the explosion of the dynamite that had destroyed all their supplies and extra ammunition. Bull walked up.
Hey, boss. I hate to tell you this, but two of the sentries are dead also.
Eight men dead. That leaves us with 21. 22 count me.
And some of them are wounded. They've done so bad they can't ride. And they've scattered the horses, boss. It'll take hours to try and round them up. What are we gonna do then, boss? Just sit around here and wait for them to hit us again?
No. We're going to start walking as fast as we can towards the border.
Walking? But Hammer, the snow's almost 2 feet deep.
That's all right. Figure it's less than 10 miles to the border and only another 5 to Noyes. We got at least another 3 or 4 hours until daylight, and on foot, we won't leave much of a trail if we're careful. We should be across the border just after sunup if we make tracks now and don't hang around here jawing about it all night.
What good's being across the border gonna do, boss?
If the men who are after us are Canadian lawmen, they won't be able to cross the border to come after us, at least not legally. If we can get to Noyes, the sheriff will swear we were there during the time of the train robbery, so we'll be safe.
I don't relish walking no 10 miles in these boots.
But then sit here on your ass when you can give our regards to those bastards when they come back here to finish the job they started. Leave everything behind except your weapons and let's make tracks.
Yeah, there ain't nothing left except in our saddles, and we sure as hell don't need those. One good thing, walking 10 miles in this weather is gonna keep us warm at any rate.
Now follow me, men, and walk in a single file so the snow will cover our tracks. It should give us a few more hours while the men who attacked us try and figure out which way we went.
Back at their camp, Smoke and his men sat near the fire, warming up after their raid. Cal had made more coffee, and they were drinking it and eating the last of the food they'd fixed the night before. Lewis passed around a small bottle of brandy he had in his saddlebags.
Here you go, boys. Add a little of this to the coffee. It'll warm your insides a bit.
What we gonna do now, Smoke? Go back and hit them again?
No, they're pretty well armed. And even counting the men we killed, they've still got us outnumbered about 5 to 1.
Yes, and without any food or supplies left, they're going to be getting awfully hungry before too long, especially in this cold weather.
Yeah, we scattered their mounts pretty good, so they won't be going nowhere until they can manage to gather them back up.
Which we don't intend to let them do, Cal. We'll keep them on foot, let them get good and hungry before we go after them again. By tomorrow afternoon, I think they'll be softened up enough for us to take another shot at them. I don't think they'll venture out into the darkness for the rest of the night, not knowing how close we are. So let's get a few hours of sleep so we'll be fresh and ready for them tomorrow morning.
Smoke woke up just after sunup and stoked the coals from the campfire into a fire large enough to cook them some breakfast. The storm had abated, and there were only isolated snowflakes falling gently on a soft breeze. As they filled up on fatback and beans and biscuits made fresh by Pearlie, they discussed their plan of attack against the outlaws.
First, we'll find out what the bastards are up to. I suspect they'll be scattered out trying to run down their horses. If that's the case, we should be able to take out a few more of them from a distance without too much trouble.
What if they're still bunched up in their camp?
Then we'll surround them and use our long guns to pick them off one at a time until they decide to surrender.
That's right, Lewis. We should be all right if they try to mount a counterattack, since we'll have our horses and they'll still be on foot. But one way or another, they're going to be in our custody by this afternoon. Or they're going to be dead.
When they were finished with breakfast, Cal and Pearlie struck the camp while Smoke and Lewis got extra ammunition off the pack horses and made sure all of the rifles and pistols were loaded. Once they were ready, Smoke took the lead and they moved out toward the outlaws' camp. They kept a close watch to make sure they didn't come up on any of them unexpectedly. As they crested the rise where they'd observed the enemy camp the night before, Smoke and Lewis took out their binoculars and took a long look at the deserted camp below.
That's strange. I don't see any sign of life in the camp.
You're right, Lewis. I see several bodies lying where they fell, but there's no sign of other men in the area.
They didn't even bother to bury their dead.
I guess they figure coyotes and wolves need to eat, same as worms.
You think they might be out looking for their mounts?
No, I don't think so, Cal. We would have seen them on the way up here if that were the case, since we scattered their horses towards our camp.
Maybe they're hiding in the woods nearby, just waiting for us to show ourselves so they can ambush us.
Yeah, well, that's possible.
Smoke sat up in his saddle and looked all around the camp through his glasses, but he could see no sign of the outlaws.
I guess we have to split up and check out the area on all sides of the camp. But I want you to go slow and be very careful. If you see any sign of them, fire off a shot, and the rest of us will come running.
The four men each took off in separate directions, walking their horses slowly, with their guns in their hands, ready in case of an ambush. 2 hours later, they met up at the outlaws' camp again, having seen no sign of the outlaws. Smoke got down off his horse and walked slowly around the perimeter of the camp, bending over and staring at the ground as he walked. After a while, he straightened up and looked off to the south.
Look here.
I don't see anything.
The snow is an inch or so shallower than the surrounding snow is, and the depression seemed to run towards the south.
What's that mean, Smoke?
I think the outlaws took off walking to the south, and they walked in single file, hoping the snow would cover their tracks. But the depression their feet caused in the snow caused the new snow to be several inches shallower than the surrounding snowfall.
How long ago?
From the depth of the snow, I'd say they've got about 5 or 6 hours on us at least.
Why would they head south? There ain't nothing that way for miles and miles.
Nothing except the Canadian border.
Well, they can't go far on foot.
The average man can walk at 2 to 4 miles an hour, Pearlie. That means if they've been going steady for 5 or 6 hours, they could have made 10 to 15 miles. Farther if they're hurrying.
It'd be hard to keep up at that pace in this weather with no food or warm drinks. But you're right, Lewis. They could be pretty close to the border by now.
What difference does that make to us?
None, Cal. They're probably figuring we're Canadian authorities and won't be able to cross the border after them. And that's where they've made their big mistake. One that's going to cost them either their freedom or their lives, depending on how stupid they are. Now, let's see just how far they've gotten.
I hope they get frostbite on their feet. Serve them right.
Frostbite's the least of their worries, Cal. I'm planning on giving them some lead poisoning to worry about.